Now, Colin Paterson, who sometimes covers on this very show, has been speaking to Richard. He caught up with him this morning. And Colin started by asking, of course, the most obvious question of all, and the most necessary one, how he was doing.
Alive, Colin, that's the key thing. I'm alive.
How does it feel?
It feels tiring, is how it feels. I'm out of the coma, I'm out of the emergency. I spent 12 nights in intensive care, and then the last two nights in the high dependency unit. I've now started therapy. And Rebecca does therapy separately. And we're both big believers in therapy. We live in a town in which people believe in therapy in Los Angeles. And as the therapist explained to me yesterday, in many ways you're still in the thick of it. You know, there's still a lot to deal with, to process. I can't eat properly. I don't sleep properly. And the next stage for me is, the infection is completely gone and it's over. But it's about dealing with the psychological scars, I guess.
Well, for listeners who've been on holiday, managed to miss this story, let's go right back to the start.
I was flying home from America. We're in Blackheath right now. This is my mother-in-law's house.
Beautiful garden, by the way.
It's a beautiful... She'll be very pleased to hear that on the radio.
Good.
She works very, very hard at this garden.
Any flowers I should particularly mention?
There's those thorns over there. See those purple thorns up there?
Beautiful thorns.
They're beautiful thorns. I think they might have a more technical name than that, but to me, they're just thorns. We come here and, so the kids can spend time with grandma because we live abroad. And I felt really ill on the flight. I started to hallucinate and I felt really cold. It was like it was winter on the flight. I couldn't walk when I landed at Heathrow, so I was wheeled through Heathrow.
So you were fine before you got on the flight?
I was feeling a bit weird. It was the day that England won that game on penalties.
Against Colombia.
Yeah, that was the last World Cup game that I saw. It was all over by the time I woke up. And
who broke the news to you that England were out?
I think of footballers coming from France. So to me, football, has come home. And what's really sweet is when I was in the coma, they played the football on the screen. Because I'm not really into football or soccer, as we call it. But I do enjoy the World Cup and I do enjoy the drama of it. And one of the weird things, when you're in a coma with a lung infection, one of the drugs they use to put you under is in itself hallucinogenic, and you can actually take in things. So I heard some of the World Cup, and a couple of weeks later, I would meet members of staff who I'd only met unconscious, and I'd recognise their voice straight away, and I'd say, hey, nice to see you again. Nice to meet you again. But we'll come back to that. But I got wheeled through the airport in a wheelchair, and I did feel a bit funny before the flight. The flight was the worst of my life. We then came here, and I was already short of breath. The mistake I made was not to go straight to A&E, and I would urge anybody who's short of breath to go straight to A&E. I think most people would.
But if you're off a long plane flight, you probably just thought, I'll have a good night's sleep and I'll be better the next day.
I probably did think that. I've really embraced fitness this year. This has been the healthiest of my life. Plus, I'm too optimistic. I separately this year got diagnosed with ADHD, and one thing I've learned about my own brain is being too optimistic. It's probably net positive, there are absolutely definitely downsides to being optimistic. It means you're not realistic, and certainly not pessimistic. And so my attitude was, I'll be fine, I'm fitter than I've ever been, I'll be fine. So we came back here, and throughout the night I kept walking into this garden we're sitting in now to get air, and I realised now I was searching for oxygen. And the next day I did a walk-in at Lewisham Hospital, and that's when it all kicked off.
So you just got up in the morning, thought, I've got to go to hospital.
Yeah, more or less.
So what happens when you walk in?
I walked into the front desk, and they saw me straight away. You expect to wait 3 hours. And I said I was short of breath, so maybe they recognised the severity straight away. They took me into a room at the back and just started running this kind of battery of tests. And it was the X-ray that did it. Maybe 3 hours into A&E, Rebecca joined me, my wife. There was a point where they'd moved us to the resuscitation unit just to keep us, not for any particular reason other than to keep us waiting whilst they made a decision. And by then I thought I'd be staying in one night. And I said to Rebecca, hey, do you think I'll make that lunch with our friends tomorrow? And at that point, this consultant turned up, the lead consultant for intensive care, who's just this man I love. He's terrific. And
you can give him a name check.
It's called Vic, but I haven't asked him if I can use his name, but his name is Vic. He's very to the point and matter of fact in a way that makes you trust him. And he talks in a way that we don't in broadcasting. It's just, these are the facts. Deal with them. Or facts as he sees them, if you like. And he said, you know what's going to happen? And I said, yeah, I think I'm going to stay overnight and you'll put some antibiotics in me and we'll get this thing dealt with. And he said, no, it's much worse than that. I've looked at the x-ray. It's horrible. And if I don't put you in an induced coma for at least a week, you're probably going to die. Now, obviously, you're legally free to turn it down, right? You know, if you want to. You know, he's not got a court order to put you into a coma. But what I did was, because I've got an inquisitive mind, that's why I like being an interviewer, in that moment, first of all, it was the most shocking moment of my life. I've very rarely seen Rebecca cry, and she cried. I thought when he said that we're going to put you under for a week, 10 days, and I was in 9 days in the end under in hospital for 2 weeks. I thought he would be doing it like 3 hours later. And I said, have I got some time to make some calls? And he said, we need to do it. It's so bad. We need to do it in the next 20 minutes. And so I go within the space of about 45 seconds from thinking I might make a lunch tomorrow to going into a coma for 9 days. And it was it was absolutely overwhelming.
What did you do with those 20 minutes?
Called one of my sisters. I called my mum and dad. And we called one of Rebecca's sisters. She's got two sisters. They're a very practical family, this family. They're very good in a crisis. So we called her sister Kirsty. And Rebecca cried a bit. And I took the phone off Rebecca just so Kirsty really understood. Kirsty immediately got it. I love you, Richard. And I said, take care of Rebecca. Right, we'll be fine. She'll be fine. You're going to be fine. Gave her the phone back. And Vic was like, let's get on with this. And actually, as he'd said, you need to go under for that length of time. I saw all these people appear in front of me. Just so remember, from might make lunch to within 45 seconds, people in scrubs, hospital bed, equipment, resuscitation machine. What I didn't understand is I assumed that they were going to put me under and they were going to put a breathing pipe and use a ventilator and help me breathe whilst they used some antibacteria to get it to go. And actually what they were doing was putting me on life support. They, for the first couple of nights, they used so many sedatives, they paralyzed me. And I was in a private room on a full life support unit, asleep for 9 days.
When you say private,
I mean private. I didn't pay for anything. I just because they thought I might be infected. It was fully the NHS, and I really want to talk about the NHS in this interview. That's why I want to do this interview, as well as having deep affection for Five Live, of course. But what I mean by private is purely I couldn't be with other people because they didn't know what it was, and they never did find out what it was. And this is a really interesting thing I learned about the NHS: is it's 30% detective work. But they're not the police, they're not the CPS, they're not the courts. They don't have to find out why. You know, it's better to find out why because they can target. It's better to find out why for future case studies and learning. But they don't have to. They just need to fix you. But in a way, when you go into hospital and they don't know what's wrong with you, it's the worst of all worlds because they have to run so many tests on you. I think in my poor arms, I think I had 250 injections. So at one point, this is after I come round, I'd had so many needles stuck in my arms that I had to ask them to stop. I said, I can't, I just can't take any more.
Too painful?
I don't mind having it. I'm very used to injections. I don't mind having injections. But after a while, they were so tired and raw. And actually, one of the hardest things, and this is going to sound like vanity, but in a way, I am fairly vain. You know, I'm on television. I don't care. It's true. And I found that the physical change, maybe the hardest thing. I look at I'd worked so hard in the gym this year. I decided to really embrace the Los Angeles lifestyle, going to the gym often twice a day, really eating cleanly, building up muscle. And to look at myself in the mirror now, I'm gaunt. The muscle has the body cleverly in an emergency will eat away at the fat and the muscle. And there was a point in my life when I wanted to be really thin, but that's not where I am now. And I'm, my muscle and my fat has just been eaten away, and I look incredibly gaunt and thin.
And have you had the tracheotomy? Because you've got the plaster on the throat.
Plaster, yeah.
Although your voice is back.
The voice is fine, yeah. It's a tracheostomy, they call it here, and a tracheotomy it's called in America. But I absolutely had that. That was a few days in, but I was asleep. That's a full scrubs operation to give you the tracheostomy. When I came, it's quite hard to explain this, that if you have a regular operation, and I've had a couple of those, where you have general anaesthetic and you're asleep for a couple of hours, you remember going under and you remember coming round, and you often feel a bit groggy and terrible, but you remember it. I remember going under. The coming round is the strangest experience of my life, because it's so long. And because it's a lung condition, they use a drug that has an hallucinogenic quality. And it means that you can hear conversations during the coma, and you actually start to piece together a fiction. And when I came round, there were several things I believed, not 95% to be true, 100% to be true. And it took a couple of days where one of the doctors had to sit me down and say, right, what do you think happened? And he talked through it, and he'd say, yeah, that did happen. And that didn't happen. You've invented that. No, that didn't happen. And there were things that I could remember happening during the coma that were accurate. And I go, yeah, we did do that. Oh, I did say that. But there were things that were just nonsense, that my brain overheard conversations and stitched together a new reality. And that's been very hard as well. I've had to unpick truth from fiction.
So your tweet about the Pulp Fiction moment with the needle in your chest, is that true?
Yeah, there was a needle in my chest. Yeah, the thing that actually turned out not to be true about that was, in that tweet, I said I was on the move, and it was explained to me I was never on the move. I never left the room. In my head, I was wheeled down a corridor in an emergency. That was about the issue about the needle in the chest. It's actually lower than that. There were points where they were struggling to get me under, and they, you know, had to use so many different needles to get me under. They brought me out after 7 days, and I had the worst day of my life. It was. What they do, they called Rebecca in the morning and said, we're going to bring him out. And they turn off all the sedatives. But actually, it's not like having a general anaesthetic where you come around 2 hours later. They turn off the sedatives, and it's hours and hours and hours later before you rejoin the world. And you don't know when that's going to be. And I would say to anyone who has a friend or relative who goes through this, is what I think we've both learned is, on the day you come round, sadly, you're going to have to put in a 14, 15-hour shift of just sitting there, because you don't know when the person's going to rejoin the world. At some point, Rebecca had to go home, put the kids to bed. And I came round, and it's a room of strangers. And I'd had all these weird drugs, and I was hallucinogenic drugs. And I was frightened, and I was really kicking off. I mean, I was actually kicking off, like to the point where they had to restrain me, kicking and...
Because you were so confused?
I was confused, and I was frightened. And in the end, they put me back under, and they brought me out again a second time, more slowly, 2 days later, which was much more effective, just much more gentle. But I was very, very confused to start with.
That was horrible. 9 days.
Coming out was the worst day of my life.
And was Rebecca there the second time?
Yeah. I mean, she was there the first time. Rebecca, you know, I have no real way of thanking Rebecca for what she's done. And we, you know, you've got to imagine the two different experiences that we've had. You know, me, imagine seeing it through my eyes and her eyes. My eyes get the news I have to go under, pepper the guy with questions because I'm inquisitive. Once I'd got the questions, once he'd satisfied my questions that I asked him before going under, I was at peace. I was like, okay, he's answered them. I've asked him. I went bam, 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 like an interview, just bam, 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 bam. And once he'd answered them all, I thought, that's it. The decision has been taken away. I'm at peace. Let's do this. But then I'm asleep and I'm in a coma. I nearly died the first two nights. And
you say that very matter-of-factly.
Yeah, well, I didn't know at the time. But it's been explained to me since that the hospital thought, on balance of probability, I would die the first night. And the second night, my blood oxygen levels got to 70%. That's essentially the rate at which oxygen dissolves into the cells in the blood. And that is life. That's what life is. And if you go below 70, you sort of get brain damage or die. So the first two nights I was at 70. I then got a fever. And the infection was winning and my lungs were losing. To be in ICU, to be in intensive care, you have to be in the top 2% of ill people in the whole of the hospital. And then within that top 2%, I was right at the top of that. And they kept saying to Rebecca, he's very ill. So Rebecca was getting this message that her husband, who's on life support in ICU, in even within that context, is very, very ill. So she was getting the message that I might die. And I've spoken to her since, and she was thinking about that. She was, you know, already she was thinking, do we stay in America? What do I do?
She was planning the future.
She was thinking, you have to, she was just planning it. But, you know, I think half thoughts formed in her head. If this happens, how do I explain it to the kids? And then when I learned about that, that's something that I'm dealing with now, is what's she been through, and what are the consequences of that? And that's one of the reasons we're both doing therapy.
Now you're able to start processing these things. You're talking about having therapy.
Yeah.
How are you beginning to look at it?
I look at it as... The thing I really dislike about it is, you know, there are plenty of times in my life where I've got myself in trouble. And that's the kind of guy that I am, and you know that. And sometimes I'll create the conditions for trouble, and the punishment will not fit the crime. I'll create the conditions, and then the hole I fall into will be bigger than the one that I dug. But this, when this was all over, I said to the lead consultant, I said, look, what can I learn from this? And he said, nothing. There's nothing you can learn. He didn't do anything wrong. And it's a really unsatisfying answer. I'd rather learn from it. So I've decided to really, really embrace health from here on in. You know, I've always drunk too much. I've always drunk too quickly. So I'm giving up drinking altogether forever as a result of what happened to me. Because if I don't affect some sort of really positive change out of this, then I don't know what it's just a massive waste of time. It's a giant waste of everyone's time. It's worse than a waste of time. It's a waste of time with massive psychological scars. You know, so I'm using it to affect positive change.
When did you decide that?
Just in the days afterwards. It's something I've been thinking about anyway. And I just want to do something different. I don't want this to want to look back, you know, in 10, 20 years, and this to be, this was the moment that I changed my life.
At moments like this, a lot of people question why we're here, the big questions in life. Is any of that going on?
Well, there was no white light, Colin. No one beckoning me to a white light, I'm sorry. I've never thought there was any purpose to life other than our capacity for friendship and sharing love and making life easier for one another and having fun and innovation, I suppose. But I you know, I don't believe in God. I don't believe there's any grand purpose. I think one day the sun will explode and eat up the earth and none of this will have been for anything. But whilst we're alive, we can alleviate each other's pain and we can love each other. And it made me think about, you know, the friendships that I'm surrounded by. To see the best of your friends, both here and in America, was a really profoundly moving thing and a wonderful thing. It made me think about the conversations that you don't have as a married couple. I was watching telly a couple of nights ago and I paused it and I said, Rebecca, by the way, I was just contemplating my own death, obviously as a result of what's happened.
What were you watching?
The new series of Unforgotten. And it's good. It's not as good as the first series. And I, Tom Courtney in the first series, you got to see it. And I said, look, do you know, I've been watching a lot. By the way, I've been watching a lot of sports since I came out of a game. You know, people say you change when you come out of a... Like, I've changed. I'm finally... Now I'm qualified to work at Five Live.
You've been watching the golf.
Sport. I've watched all of the golf. Sorry, where was
anyway,
I?
Anyway, you're contemplating death, yeah?
Contemplating death. And I said to Rebecca, look... I said, you know what? I said, by the way, if that happens again and I die, don't feel any guilt about moving on. You know, and it's not that she needed my permission, but there are certain conversations, I think, as a married couple, that you don't have that might be as important as sorting out your will. And we had this conversation, and she said the same. She said, if I die, don't feel guilty about finding someone else. Because, you know, if you're a thoughtful person and the other half suddenly dies, you may well feel guilt about when do I move on? Would they want me to ever move on? These are things that are reasonable things to think about. And so we had this conversation. I was like, I don't care if it's 2-3 months. If you find someone else, you move on.
No time limit for decency.
No time limit. Because if you find someone, move on. I want the kids to have a, you know, I want her to be in a relationship if it makes her happy, and if the person makes the kids happy. But the thing we talked about that was interesting was we agreed that we would always involve our families in our lives. So if she dies, I will move on, but I would give, you know, her mum and her sisters forever a big role in our kids' lives. And she would do the same the other way around. I did want to just conclude by saying this, Colin, which is, you know, like the BBC is funded by a tax and so is the NHS. And it's very important for me that I want to really pay tribute to the NHS in these interviews. And I'm only doing a tiny, tiny number of interviews. And then I'm going to do some fundraising for Lewisham Hospital. The government tried to close down Lewisham Hospital a few years ago.
2012.
You go there and you think, it's so busy and so good. And it serves its community so well that you can't believe there was an attempt to close it down. It's not as if you go in there and there's hardly anyone in there. It's just, it's packed. I don't understand the rationale behind it. All the equipment in there feels new and good, and the team there are outstanding. I think 50 people probably treated me in total. 50. And so it survives. It's the best team of people I've ever encountered in my life. I'm going to talk to them when I've got a bit of space and work out what they need, whether that's actual hospital equipment or maybe I'll spend a load of money or raise money and like refit the staff room with fridges and kit, I don't know, toasters and sofas and tables, just make it great. I'm going to raise as much money as I can and do something for them, because, you know, in my mind, this has been free. I live about 8 or 9 months in America and about 3 months in England each year. Earlier this year, I hurt my toe. And I went to the doctor in America. It cost me $200 to get my toe looked at. It wasn't even as much as an ingrowing toenail. I've just spent 12 nights in intensive care and 2 in the high dependency unit. 50 people looked after me and saved my life, and I walked out and there's no bill. You know, we have the best system in the world, and I know it has its problems, but it is when you live between those dual healthcare systems, you don't half understand how lucky we are. And one of my feelings is that this experience has honestly made me feel very proud to be British.
And there were so many messages of goodwill from Five Live listeners when the story broke. The text console, as they say, lit up.
Really? Oh, that's nice to hear. Obviously, I have huge affection for Five Live. It's you know, one of the most important parts of my career, and it was an absolute joy to work there and a joy to host this particular slot on Five Live. It's a brilliant and continues to be a brilliant radio station.